The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention estimates that every year, roughly 48 million people get sick from foodborne illnesses, and 128,000 are hospitalized, 3,000 die. These threats pop up on everything from raw vegetables to meats and seafoods. Recently, it was Ritz crackers and even Goldfish crackers. What am I going to do to keep my 5-year-old granddaughter quiet in the back seat? Fishborne contamination has many different sources and manifestations, making it difficult to track, recognize, and treat. To shed light on this, we are joined today by an assistant professor of medicine at UC with a specialty in digestive diseases and gastroenterology, Dr. Vithya Kunnatur. From Ohio State University, I should say from the Ohio State University, assistant professor and extension field specialist in the College of Food, Agriculture, and Environmental Services, Dr. Abigail Snyder, and environmental health manager for the Northern Kentucky Health Department, Ted Talley. To join our conversation, please join us at 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Twitter and Facebook. Welcome, everybody, to Cincinnati Edition. And Dr. Kunnatur, one of the issues here is that under this sort of heading of foodborne diseases, we're actually talking about a real spectrum of things, pathogens of all kinds, viruses, bacteria, chemical treatments, whatever. What are the most common sorts of things that are causing disease based on food that people eat?
So Salmonella and E. coli are actually some of the most common. We've had a more recent Cyclospora outbreak that's actually one of the rarer pathogens that we see. So typically it's Salmonella and E. coli that are the most common pathogens that we see. There are several others, Shigella, Yersinia, less or so. They don't occur that often, but it's really the Salmonella and E. coli.
And, you know, not that a person would know what they've been hit by, but since there are so many different potential things that you could pick up, what are the symptoms that people might have that would indicate they need to find someone to talk to? They need to find a doctor. They need some medical advice about what to do after they've eaten something.
Well, that's a great question. So slight differences, and I'm going to kind of touch on some of the more recent outbreaks with the Salmonella, E. coli, and Cyclospora. So the symptoms are slightly different, but fairly similar. So Salmonella is a bacteria. Oftentimes patients will present with bloody diarrhea. Typically it occurs within 72 hours after exposure to a food that has been carrying Salmonella. Nausea, fatigue, malaise, generalized feeling of unwellness, and those patients probably should be seeking medical care. Typically, within that 72-hour window, they'll end up having symptoms. Now, E. coli, you'll see more commonly in contaminated hamburger meat, but you can see it in produce as well and a number of other foods, mainly because you've contaminated livestock and it's contaminated through the fecal transmission. And so it affects the produce as well in terms of fertilizer and exposure that way. Those patients similarly will have some bloody diarrhea and typically within 3 to 4 days after exposure. Now, Cyclospora, you'll see more watery diarrhea, and it takes a lot longer to kind of set on. So it's usually about a week to 14 days with Cyclospora, watery diarrhea, nausea, just feeling unwell. And you'll see that more in things like raspberries and basil. But all three of those pathogens can be really seen in produce or meat. But
yeah, so in all those cases, people should seek
medical care.
Medical care if they're
Definitely.
If they're having the diarrhea, if they're having the vomiting, they're
right.
Okay. Dr. Snyder, how much of this is the result of sort of modern industrial food processing, you know, the question of hamburger and how it's pulled together and packaged and all of that? How much of this is really related to that sort of process that we're used to getting our food from at this point?
If you think about how ground beef, for example, could become contaminated with E. coli in the first place. E. coli might be resident in the gastrointestinal tract of the animal, and then through the evisceration and harvesting process, the meat could become contaminated. And specifically with a ground beef product, you integrate those contaminants into the interior of the product during grinding. So that may or may not have anything to do with, like you say, the industrial or the large-scale food distribution system that we're working in today. But certainly some of the larger outbreaks or recalls that we have been brought to our attention in recent years are a consequence of the size of the distribution system that we utilize to get food to people throughout the world. That said, the same routes of contamination or the ways in which risk can be enhanced are minimized through a variety of different mitigation strategies that range from the farm to the fork.
Okay. And just, again, sort of lay the groundwork here. Ted Talley with Northern Kentucky Health. Are we experiencing an increased number of these warnings or alerts, or is the issue sort of staying the same, but we're hearing, I feel like we're hearing about more. I don't know if there are more or we're just hearing about more. I'm not quite sure what to make of it.
Well, I think recalls have certainly increased over the years. I think part of it is probably better reporting and testing as well. I think a lot of it, we're just more in tune to it and want to make sure that we're staying healthy and the food we're receiving is in good condition. I think just a lot of better investigational type tools also exist.
Okay, so that we're actually identifying potential problems maybe
Correct.
Quicker?
Right.
More upstream?
Correct.
You know, one of the things that really surprised me, though, and that was this problem in Ritz crackers and Goldfish crackers. And my understanding is that this is a salmonella contamination from whey powder from a milk product. What I'm surprised at is I would have thought that would have been dealt with somehow in the baking process, that that would have been solved. Why would something like a cracker all of a sudden appear as a potential problem, Dr. Kunitor?
I mean, some of that is with the processing, and I kind of wonder if that powdery residue that you see on those Ritz crackers and various crackers is actually added after the baking process, which is probably why it still sort of stayed. Because typically salmonella should be killed with high heat cooking.
And I would think that
right.
there's crackers, in order to get them into that crispy right. form, have to go maybe real quick, but have to go into through pretty high heat,
right.
pretty high ovens.
Right.
So this could be sprayed on afterwards.
Exactly.
Just to be clear, when we say whey, W-H-E-Y, what is that? Is that curds and whey?
Well, it's whey protein, basically. It's a protein, and it's a milk derivative, essentially. So,
okay. So what are, and Dr. Snyder, what are sort of the main things out there in our diets that we should just be aware of and that can be a problem for having contamination?
Well, no foods are zero risk, so I think it's worth putting that out there to begin with. And as you kind of alluded in your previous question, foods that go through some sort of kill step or a thermal process that would kill or inactivate pathogens that have contaminated the food, that's a way of minimizing the risk of contracting a foodborne illness. In contrast, foods that are raw or minimally processed and don't undergo some sort of kill step are potentially higher risk, and you're more dependent on preventative programs like sanitation to prevent cross-contamination. So fresh produce, for example, while we acknowledge it has a lot of health benefits in terms of consumption for a healthy diet, is relatively high risk as a vector for transmitting foodborne disease. And the same go for other non-thermally processed foods. So if you're a big fan of eating raw oysters, or unpasteurized juices, those are higher risk because there's not a control step to inactivate potential pathogens that contaminate those foods.
So if milk or you're saying fruit juices aren't pasteurized, Therefore, I mean, they've been heated very quickly before they cooled down. That – and there is sort of an interest in getting back to unpasteurized milk. I know that for some people, that is a potential problem. That's a potential source here.
Yeah, raw products, especially those where we have really convenient intervention strategies like pasteurization, are higher risk for that same reason. Now, there is research ongoing for non-thermal processes that can still kill pathogens but maintain some of those fresh-like qualities. So, for instance, high-pressure processing, where instead of heat, a lot of PSI is used to kill pathogens but keep fresh-like ingredients, is used in cold-pressed juices, is kind of the trend that you might see. So some of those $8 bottles at the grocery store with non-thermal processes optimize those two goals.
PSI, pounds per square inch?
Yes, pressure. Correct.
Pressure. Okay. And Ted, one of the things that as I was reading about this, it seems like it's the various foods themselves, like the fresh fruits and vegetables, if they're not washed properly, if chicken's not handled properly and kept separate from other things, you know, it's the how things are handled. What are some of those sort of basic principles that you probably look for in restaurants that you're inspecting, but you might pass on to people about what they should be doing in their homes?
Yeah, we do. So it's kind of a four-step process when we're dealing with food safety, especially at home. We call it clean, separate, cook, and chill. So clean initially, we want to start with proper hand washing, 20 minutes, warm soapy water, make sure we get our fingertips, palms, thumbs, things like that.
Wait a minute, 20 minutes?
I'm sorry, 20 seconds.
Okay, pardon me.
Those would be very clean hands,
I'm
right?
Not operating on anybody. I'm just, okay.
And then after that, we want to make sure we clean our produce the best we can. So a lot of the times there's actually like citric-based produce washers out there that you can actually use. Then again, just plain old clean water will do the job. Secondly, we want to separate. So we want to make sure that we keep our raw products away from our ready-to-eat products or things that are not going to require any type of cooking. And then also make sure we have plenty of utensils, cutting boards, things like that, so we have that separation.
Well, I know that separation on cutting boards. Do you recommend a cutting board, let's say you're using a hard plastic cutting board, and that it never be, if it's used for vegetables, it never be used for anything else, or just that make sure it's washed well between
uses. Yeah.
Okay.
Correct.
Okay. So it doesn't have to be totally separated.
It does not.
Okay. One of the things, again, that I was reading about was a particular area of concern was the area of sprouts. That alfalfa sprouts, other kinds of sprouts, because of the way they're grown, can be particularly attuned to in picking up the various sorts of problems. Is Dr. Kunitar, is that your understanding?
It is, and there's actually a lot of food chains that don't even use sprouts anymore
for that reason.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So it definitely can pick up a little bit more just because of the way it's processed. And maybe Dr. Snyder could speak to it.
Dr. Snyder, do you have anything to say about sprouts?
Yeah, there's less to say about sprouts.
Okay.
You're right that some restaurant chains have decided to move away from including sprouts on the menu or on a salad bar because it's just too high risk. So sprouts are grown in moist, warm environments where the seed germinates to get the sprout that you want. But those are also conditions that perfectly incubate the pathogens that we were listing at the start of this presentation. And so with the advent of the Food Safety Modernization Act, there's actually increased guidance and regulatory oversight for sprouters so that there are some science-based guidance for people who are trying to produce or want to consume sprouts to do so as safely as possible. But by virtue of the growing conditions, like you say, they are high risk for contamination and facilitating outgrowth of foodborne pathogens.
One of the things Dr. Snyder just mentioned there, and Ted, your department does inspection of restaurants. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about buffets?
I think if they're properly monitored, they're safe. A lot of times what we have is more of a lack of education or practice on the consumer end. So if they're properly monitored, they're okay.
If they're properly monitored.
If they're properly monitored.
That indicates to me you've seen ones that weren't properly monitored.
That's correct. Sometimes they can be challenging.
Because things get mixed, because they're in there too long, because...
Well, a lot of times, too, we have temperature control issues with our buffet bars, just the way the pans are set. They may not be deep enough or too deep. They're not contacting the water or the heating elements. A lot of times, even on the cold end, it can be a challenge as well. And then, once again, just sometimes the consumer, how many times have we walked up to the salad bar and actually saw the salad tongs in the salad instead of having that handle out? So that's what needs to be monitored.
And then we all reach in for
it. We all reach in for it.
Yes. Dr. Snyder, a couple things. One is, what if you have a home garden? Do all of these concerns still apply? And two, what about if you're buying from organic people who are growing organically? Do things apply?
Yeah, certainly that's true. So whether or not you're growing produce in your home garden, or if you're purchasing produce that is organic or conventional, it's possible to get produce that is safe or less safe based on how the produce was produced and handled after it was harvested. So your local county extension office has a lot of recommendations for home gardeners if they're interested in food safety recommendations, but you might think about routes of transmission that you're going to try and manage if you're a home gardener. So a lot of these foodborne diseases are spread through the fecal-oral route. So effectively, it's fecal contamination that gets onto your fruits and veggies. You eat that, and then that's how you are exposed to something like E. coli or salmonella. So where's your water source? Do wild or domestic animals have access to your garden? How do you handle produce once it's harvested? What kind of containers are you using? Those kind of considerations are important.
Okay. Dr. Kunator, are there particular segments of the population that are susceptible or should be especially aware of these sorts of issues? Or is this something, I mean, we all should be aware of it in a general sense, but are there certain groups of people who ought to be more aware?
Definitely. So age over 60 and the very young, so children, infants particularly, are susceptible, and patients that are immunocompromised, whether they be on chemotherapy or HIV/AIDS. So they should be a little bit more cautious than the average person in terms of consumption of some of these foods and just safety precautions they should be taking.
Okay. Ted, it was mentioned earlier, washing vegetables particularly. Fruits and vegetables is it water? You mentioned that there's these other products out there. Is there a significant, worthwhile advantage to some other product, not by name, but by type, that really is worth pulling into this?
I've seen some studies where they say that citrus-based produce cleaners, do an effective job. But then again, I think, water does a great job as well.
Okay. So you're not jumping up and down that—
I'm not.
You have to use some—
Correct.
—outside thing. Dr. Snyder, do you have any particular different view about that, or is that sort of where you are too?
I only might add that on produce where it's possible, the addition of some sort of physical action like scrubbing with a produce brush can increase the efficacy of that treatment because it aids in the removal of some contaminants. Plus, a lot of the reason that we wash fruits and vegetables is just to remove visible soil or debris. So you might think about something like a cantaloupe that has a netted surface on the outside and is relatively resilient against physical action. A produce brush might be useful in those cases. And I might also suggest waiting to do a wash, if you're going to use a sanitizer treatment or not, until just prior to consumption. You might increase the rate of spoilage if you do it and then put it back in the refrigerator and wait too long.
Okay, so let it stay when you've bought it from your vendor, whoever that is, let it stay and wash it just before you use it. And what about this is the summer, what about grilling out? How important is the right temperature on meat that has been fixed? I mean, it's one thing when you've got a more controlled environment in a kitchen, But, I go out to the grill and I'm guessing as to how long it's been on there and how thick it is. And I'm making, mental calculations, which may have a lot to do with how hot it is. And, how important is it to use a thermometer?
Very important.
Very important.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Color change is usually not the best indicator to see if food's done. So, yes, a meat thermometer, get into the geometric center, make sure you're getting the proper temperature. So chicken, 165, ground beef, 155, pork, fish, things like that, 145.
Okay. So you highly recommend that.
Yes, sir.
Do you grill out yourself?
I do.
And do you have a thermometer?
I do.
Okay.
I have several.
Just wanted to check on that. So,
interestingly, though, foodborne illnesses at home aren't as common as commercially prepared items. So we don't see them as commonly from people who've contracted them from preparing things at home.
Why do you think that is?
I think that the safety precautions that people take at home, I would assume are probably better than somebody that's rushed in a kitchen sometimes when they're mass production of food, some of these salad bars, the meat. And I think they may not take as much care to prepare the item as someone at home might.
Ted, what would you say about that? Because I guess I would have thought maybe there were standards in restaurants that the government is supervising how things are handled and that maybe they would be stricter than what we're doing at home.
Right. And I agree with that as well. I think what we're seeing is a trend of a lot of people eating out as well instead of staying at home. So I think that may be also what we're seeing is the increase in numbers. But you're right. I mean, we do have high standards in our restaurants that they have to adhere to. But I'm like everyone else, things get busy and we're not properly handling food and causing a potential issue there.
Okay. On an ongoing basis, are there certain foods, time periods that you're particularly concerned about? Or is it just what we've already talked about? If we hit the high points?
Summertime is usually a time when we see more outbreaks, wouldn't you say?
It is, and I think that's just kind of the condition of people being outside and grilling out and keeping those perishable foods at improper temperature too long.
Okay. Well, I'd like to thank all three of our guests for being with us today. Great conversation. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. Segment producer is Layla Shakui. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives of our program are available on the website wvxu.org. I'm Dan Hurley. Stay tuned for Here and Now, next on 91.7 WVXU.